Thank you, Joe. I'm so honored to be here. This is just so cool. The thing that pleases me most is this, how the Dharma is growing in small places. It's not a big, fancy, golden, dingle-dangle kind of thing at all. It's just some small, beautiful space where everyone can gather. A safe space, a quiet space, where we can begin to become more familiar with ourselves and how big we are and what a big world it is. So it just pleases my heart. I started sitting in a place just like this. It was called Haiku Zendo because there were 17 cushions. I don't know that anybody wrote haiku then, but Suzuki Roshi established it. And my teacher was sent for and came from Japan to help Suzuki Roshi establish Tassajara, the first monastery in America. And my teacher, Kogenchino Otogawa Roshi, was sort of a star monk at Eheiji. He'd gone through the hazing and all the intensity of practice there, and had stayed to train the new monks. And he, in his own inimitable way, asked the abbot if he could please train them by not beating on them. Because the way they do it to this day is they have a huge stick like this, only very long and very broad, and it's classically used to relax this muscle. And this muscle, when you've been sitting a long time, the monk will come by and whack you. And it sounds terrible, it sounds like murder is happening, but what happens is that all the tension that's built up in here just goes right back down to the belly again. So it's delicious, really. It's a very big help in a long sit. But what they do in a lot of the training places in Japan is use that stick to beat the tar out of the young monks and scare them so that they're bruised and bloody. And Koban just thought that was horrible. So he asked the abbot, which one isn't supposed to ever do, and he just went and asked if he could not use the stick, and he got permission and trained that whole year. He trained the monks without using it, except once, he said. There was one really naughty monk. Finally, he had to use it once. Calm him down a little bit. So he became the teacher after Suzuki Roshi became too ill to take care of Haiku Zendo. Koban moved into the neighborhood, a little suburb in the Bay Area of San Francisco, and lived around the corner and came to the Zendo, and we all came. We were very shy, and slowly learned how to do this thing, and began to have sesshins very close to where I lived. Just down the hill and across the street was a youth hostel. And we took it all apart and put mats on the floor and zafus and zabutans and created a week-long sesshin right there in the middle of a ranch and a youth hostel. It was fabulous. Peacocks on the roof and cows lowing. It was great. And I could go and then go home and take care of my kids whenever I needed to. So I was a going back and forth kind of sitter for a long time. And at first it was disturbing because it felt like the Zendo was this sacred, quiet, holy place, and there we all were doing this very spiritual thing, and then I'd go home to three sons, three little boys, tearing the place apart, and everybody needing something. And then I'd have to gear up in a whole nother mode, and I felt there was an enormous difference between the two. But after a while, I began to realize that there was a road between the Zendo and my house, And that the whole thing was flowing back and forth. It was just completely connected. There was no difference really at all. The ambiance was different, totally different. But the essence of it, which was what I was practicing, was wherever. And that was the first really profound lesson I ever had in sitting, was that it isn't in one particular place. The place is a gift to us to help us find that place in ourselves. So we can be anywhere and sit on anything and be fine. The way the Buddha did. He just bunched up some grass and sat down on it. This week up at Hokoji, up in Arroyo Seco, we had a sesshin, a 4-week, in which I talked about the paramitas all week. They're the 6 bodhisattva practices. And it was, as always, I learned so much. There's no better way of learning something than trying to teach it, so-called. Really, everything gets to be very serious and interesting. And I came away with the feeling so strongly of how physical this practice is, that it's all, first of all, and last of all, about the body. We think of Buddha and bodhisattvas and all these things, that all these fabulous ideas, the Dharma, everything that we just chanted. Really, what we just chanted was all about eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. So it all comes back to this skin bag full of blood and bones that we call meat. And when I thought of the paramitas, I thought how utterly physical they are too. That first one is generosity, that's a gesture from me to you. It's a gesture of any kind of giving, including giving a feeling of safety. Precepts is the second one, and that's all about how to be. Not to kill, steal, lie, etc. Those are all activities. It's all about action. Patience is about not acting. It's about counteracting our anger, our irresponsible gestures. So that's a very profound action, really, of the body. And vitality is about the vitality that builds in us as we allow ourselves to develop as we are, rather than becoming so distracted by the world that we lose sense of our own essence, essential being. And that comes down to then meditation, which is absolutely a physical thing that we're doing. This wonderful, wonderful practice. Koban used to say how grateful he was for Zazen. And he would have tears in his eyes. It's hard to explain to anybody who hasn't had the experience because it looks so bizarre, actually. Staring at a wall is not exactly inspiring from the outside, and yet we all know what a big world it is. And how grateful we can be that somehow we came to this practice, or it came to us. And the last one is prajna, or wisdom. Wisdom, compassion, which is the shine of it, the total shine of wisdom. So the action is completely mutual of the receiving the shine of the world and shining. wonderful. After we stayed in the youth hostel for a number of years doing our sesshins, we got really tired of hauling all the stuff back and forth. We had to bring all the pots and pans and all the orioki and all the everything. It was a pain. So we got ambitious and bought some property. In fact, we bought two pieces of property. Half the group wanted a city place and the other half wanted a country place, and we had an argument. So we just split the difference and we did both. We were fortunate to be able to do that. And I ended up at the country place where a number of extremely disaffected young people had ended up. This was in the 80s, I guess. They were Vietnam War vets and runaway kids and a lot of very unhappy people. And they'd been kicked out of another place, so they just moved in on this place that had four buildings and then a whole lot of geodesic domes that had been built up in the hills. So they just moved in. And when we bought it, they told us that nobody owns the land, only God owns the land, so we didn't have any right to be there. So we, Coben said, well, we're going to have a zendo here, and we're going to sit meditation. Please come and join us. They couldn't believe it. And so they did. They came in their smelly socks, in their old blue jeans, and they had no clue what it was about, but they were curious. And so that began a number of years of our practicing in this kind of situation that was really quite difficult. And yet, in every sense, Coben always said, please come in. Please. And so I learned to do that too, which I never would have done otherwise. There were some really bad characters up there. So it was a scary guy who had been in San Quentin, for instance, and had taken over a dome not too far from the zendo and painted it purple. And he had rock music playing extremely loudly all during sesshin. So that was his contribution. He called himself Wizard. There were a lot of characters like that. And little by little, it became too difficult. And the board, which were the city folks, didn't like it anymore. They just thought it was too horrible. So we had to disband the group that was living there. And little by little, they all went away. But in the course of that, it was obvious to me that it's how we are with each other that makes the difference. Another student of Coben who was doing Jikoji with me, and we went to see Wizard one day and asked him about something, and he was lying in bed, and he looked at us, and he said, you know, ladies, I could put something right, a little thing right in your neck at a certain place and kill you just like that. He looked at us, ha ha. We said, oh, really? That's nice. And then we went out and shook. But it gave us the sense that you don't have to be belligerent in order to move things. Everything moved. It moved slowly and weirdly, a lot of it. It was all sort of awful a lot of the time. And yet, slowly, slowly, in terms of Zazen practice, because we kept on sitting, just coming back to the sitting and dropping off everything else, and then coming out and bowing to everyone. You know, nice to see you. And it was, you know, it's strange, but you get to like people, whoever they are, if you're around them. And we got kind of fond of Wizard, even though he was a pain in the neck. And the interesting thing is, too, that he and some of the runaway boys came back later. Some of the runaways became caretakers up there and were a huge help. And Wizard still continues to come back, and he's dressed in a suit and tie and looks like, you know, a sort of normal person now. And he just talks about how wonderful it is at Chikoji. What a great place and what a wonderful experience he had there. So that too was, you know, tremendous training for me. I always say Chikoji was my training. People say, oh, I went to Tassajara and I learned all these things, and Koma never taught us all those things. He said, make it up. It was really mean. It was hard. It would have been much easier if he just told us. We'd watch him to see how he did it. You know, he'd do the bow, and then he'd do the incense and all these things. And then I'd think, now I know how to do it. And then the next day, he would do it differently. So, that was a very interesting kind of training, a powerful kind of training, and it was all on the ground. It was all physical, all running around. But it included Zazen as an enormous part of it. So when I start to get distracted by the ideas, when I get all involved with the Lotus Sutra and the fabulous visions and the views and the thousands of Buddhas on the thousands of seats and the thousands of this and that, and I think, yeah, it's fabulous, but how about this? This right here. This right now. This is real practice. This is how we do. So maybe that's enough to get a discussion started. You all must have something to contribute. Maybe a question to ask.
I have a question. How did your family incorporate your practice? Because, am I correct that your spouse was not into Zazen and your children weren't either?
No, they weren't. But my husband loved Koban. He just thought he was great. Koban was very short, very soft-spoken, very gentle, and just very loving Japanese man whose English wasn't very good. And my husband, 6'2" and broad and Dutch, so they made a funny pair, but they got along really, really well. Koban went skiing with us a couple of times, and we had some good times together just as a family. And my boys liked him also. They loved him. In fact, they were devastated when he died, more than I was really amazed at how shocked they were and hurt by it. So they didn't sit, but they certainly were a part of the whole atmosphere of it from the beginning. In the beginning, my husband, of course, thought I'd gone off the deep end. he thought it was a cult, and he would have been. Yeah. But once he met Koban, he understood and was mostly patient. And once Chikoji got going, all four of them spent a lot of time up there making things or cleaning things up. There was this huge mess. And my youngest son had a truck, so he just put all the dreck in the truck and took many, many dump runs. And my husband built a table that's still there that we use to when we eat orioki at the table. It's the table my husband made. So everywhere I look, there are things like that. It felt very good to have that connection. Thank you. Yeah.
question. So, as the Japanese teachers are passing away from our practice in the U.S., and we are just us all practicing together,
mm-hmm.
It seems like we're in a situation here where there's not the teacher here. There's a couple of priests.
Mm-hmm.
We have teachers who pass through and
yes.
spend time with us. But I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about how we practice with teachers, either with their absence or presence, and what a teacher is in any way.
Well, it's a good question, and I don't think we've worked out the answer really quite. And I've been involved in that way all through, because Coben, for one, was never dependable as a teacher. He'd say he was coming, and then he wouldn't come. So that's how I ended up in this, like this, because he did that at Jikoji more and more. I think that was his way of training me, was making me be the, instead of Coben person, when everybody came, and of course they were mad as heck at me. You know, where's Coben? You're the one? It wasn't easy. But I think that was his way. And I've come to think that there's some wisdom in that. A lot of my practice is visiting other sanghas where they don't have a steady teacher. Arcata, California being one of them, where Alan Sanaki and I have been taking turns going up there. And now Mark Lancaster is considering moving up there and actually being the teacher. I'm very curious to see what's going to happen. It will change the dynamic of the whole situation. It should be... Alan and I have been working toward that for a long time, trying to help them know how to do things so that when a teacher did come, they would be prepared for it. It's been a really wonderful practice. We don't know how it's all going to work out. You know, we're all experimenting as we go. And we've been given these nice Japanese forms that a lot of which really don't work in America very well. They just don't apply to our bodies or our way of life. So I think it's going to take another couple hundred years to sort it all out until it becomes a Western transition to the Western mind, you could say. And it's gone that way through history, from India to China, and it became Chinese, it became Confucian, you know, it became all based on the family. Only it was the monks who were the family then, and the teacher was the dad, and it was all set up in the Confucius way. And then it went to Japan and became very Japanese, and they dropped a lot of the Chinese part of it. And now the Japanese are really upset with us. They say we're not doing it right. They want us to train in Japan and do it just like they do. And there's a lot of tension there because it can't work that way.
Is that what the Chinese said about the Japanese? Did the Chinese think the Japanese weren't doing it the right way?
Oh, yeah.
And the Indians didn't think that the Chinese were doing it the right way.
Aren't we silly? Yes.
As it spreads.
Yes. Yes. And of course our world is becoming more and more, the culture is becoming more the same. So if we all have the same culture, it won't be so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It will be very interesting in another 50 years even, because we all know about each other so much now. We know what's happening in Ethiopia, and they know what's happening here. So it's very different and very new, this that we're in. And of course it's very disturbing too and upsetting for people. So another good reason to sit, I think, to create kind of space for it, because it's difficult time we're in.
You mentioned that you thought
some of the forms or other things don't match with our bodies or our way of life and things like that. Do you have any feel for what are the most, the things that are going to be the most difficult or the things that kind of, from your point of view, stand out as not fitting well with the transition to the West?
Well, there's a lot more lay life and family life in Zazen practice in America than there is monastic. So that already, and if the Japanese situation with the temples and the temple priest and the temple wife and the temple children and the whole system, it's all very elaborate and fairly new. It just doesn't make any sense for America. So, and it's not working in Japan either very well now. Those poor little temples are trying to survive on funerals and memorial services. So they have this whole system of not only having a funeral and then a memorial, then a few years later another one, and then a few more years, and it goes on and on and on that way. So one family will have to pay the temple over and over through the years for one death. So that's how they survive. But that's not being so popular anymore. And the younger, the older son in each of those families is supposed to go to Aheiji and do that, I don't know, marine kind of training that it is, and then come back and take over the temple. And there are a lot of young men who aren't keen to do that. And a lot of young women who are miffed because they're not included. So already it's changing considerably.
Yeah. I'm the nurse said, I don't remember the name of the stick.
Nyoi.
Nyoi?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
A teaching stick. Coben called it a don't shake stick. If you hold on to it, you
don't shake.
This is a piece of African wood, very, very hard wood, that a friend found at Slide Ranch at the beach in Marin County, that somehow came all the way from Africa into the Pacific Ocean and washed up on Slide Ranch's beach. And it's very smooth on one side and it's completely grooved on the other side. It's amazing. So that it's a great demonstration if I want to talk about form and emptiness. You know, it's just one stick. But and if you only saw this side, you'd say, it's grooved. I know it's grooved. Look, it's really grooved. It's a grooved stick. And then you flip it. Oops! So what is it? Who knows? And the other way to look at it is to say, it's a stick. It's a nyoi. I know it's a nyoi. It's has grooves on one side and smooth on the other, and Coben gave it to me, and I know that's what it is. And then your neighbor's dog will come in and grab it. It will be something entirely different. So, it's... when I first received it, I received it in a funny way, and the way I received everything from Coben. In this case, there was a little memorial service going on during Sesshin because somebody's grandfather had died. And Coben called me up and he said, come up to the altar. And I did, and he just handed it to me. Didn't tell me anything. I just stood there and he went on chanting. So then I had to ask him what the heck this is all about. And he said, oh, just don't. Just take it with you. So then it became kind of a, you know, me and my women friends got kind of interested in this and how you're supposed to hold it. there's that whole gender thing that gets into it, and we thought, well, is this really proper for a woman?
Yeah.
So it's still kind of a question, but I'm very happy to have it. It kind of is a finishing touch on something that is so mysterious, and it's consoling. It's a connection with my teacher, with my friend who made it, with the Pacific Ocean, you know, with all of those things.
How long have you had it?
20 years, something like that.
One of the perennial questions that comes up here, when we're done here, we'll chant the Bodhisattva vows.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the perennial questions that comes up is about...
how do you save all sentient beings?
Yes.
Of course. Oh, I know.
Do they want to be saved anyway?
And who are they?
Right.
Yeah. My favorite take on that, there's so many ways of looking at it. My favorite is Hui Neng's, where he says, I vow to save the sentient beings of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's how I understand and meet and take in and identify anybody else. It's really about the mystery between self and other. What is this that we call me? And who are you? All the other youths in the world. How do we be with others? That's what it's about. And so in Floating Thunder, we changed the wording to say we vow to be with all things. And not just everybody, but all things. When we incorporated it, Chikoji, we asked Koban about membership, and he said, oh, tell the state that our membership is all sentient beings. So we did. And they were fine with it.
That's good to know. So we're covered.
Yes. Yes. That's your part.
Good.
That's your part. So are the ants and the bugs and the stars
right.
And everything. Yeah. I think that's the only way to understand it. It can't mean that we're sitting in a high place and looking down our noses at the poor sods down there. That isn't what happened with Buddha. Buddha's great occasion and insight was to see that all beings are enlightened. That's what he said when he saw the star. All beings are enlightened. That's why when we sit zazen together like this, we're all Buddha together. We're not worshiping Buddha or praying to Buddha. We're being Buddha. So what saving all sentient beings means is that we go out to meet Buddha wherever we go.
I was hiking yesterday, and it was in the 4th of July Canyon in the Amazonas, and I was with a friend, and it's really fun when you're hiking like this and you pass people along the way, and sometimes you say hi, but sometimes you just sort of carry on a conversation, like two people were coming down and made a comment about the sky or something, and it wasn't a hi or a bye, it was just a comment, and we replied and laughed, and then a couple more people came along and had another comment. We had another conversation with them, but there was no hello and goodbye, and so it was like we kept just passing ourselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, the
yes.
entire time. We were just having a continual conversation with us.
Yes. Yes.
It was really wonderful.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. It's very simple, really. But usually we have a lot of fear and self-protection, and we don't talk to strangers because our mommy told us not to. And, you know, we have a lot of conditioning that tells us not to do that. But it's wonderful. And in the woods and in the wilderness, you can do that.
And I just opened my house up as a bed and breakfast. Uh-huh. And there's a website called Arab Bed and Breakfast where you can people can sign up on the web. And so last weekend I had a couple of people from New York, and this weekend I have a couple of people from Israel. Mm-hmm. And then and there's one girl that's kind of staying through, and it's the same thing all over again. It's these two people come in and they just conversations and they leave. And what was really wonderful about the man and his son from Israel was they came in and they just kind of spread their stuff out and set up camp, and we had some coffee, and then I left the house with them in my house, not only having known them for just an hour maybe.
Yeah.
And with complete, and I came back and they had left all of their things out, their iPad and, you know, their computers and cameras and things, with full trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's just what it should always be about, you know.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yes.
But also that same continuing conversation.
Yes.
With people coming and going.
And trust is the operative word there. It's trust that makes that possible. Our trust and everyone's trust. So that if we can generate enough trust in ourselves, then we can offer it to people, and then they can feel it too.
Right.
Yeah.
And how would you respond in that aspect to a situation here in town? I heard about a few years ago, Hidden Mountain Zendo, when they were here in town. All their shoes were stolen during session.
Oh.
Outside the Zendo.
Oh.
And, you know. You came out to Tukin and all the shoes were there.
What a dirty trick, huh? Wow.
Somebody must have needed shoes.
Yes. Sort of like St. Bridget. She gave away everything. She got all carried away about generosity, and she gave away all her own things, and then she gave away her mom's things and her dad's, and her dad drew the line when she gave away a shoe. She said, "Bridget, that's too much." Oh. They had a lot of trouble, didn't they? I know Hidden Mountain, they had a deal of it. Life is suffering.
Where was Hidden Mountain? It wasn't in a good area of town. I don't know the address.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They're no longer there. They're outside of Santa Fe now.
Uh-huh. Well, anything else?
You can continue next door over apple juice and cookies.
Let's do.
So we have our closing chant, which is on the first page of the